You know that old joke about the farmer, the one who wants to increase his milk production, so he goes and hires a theoretical physicist?
Oh, I think I know this one. The physicist comes back and says, I have a solution.
Right. But it only works for a spherical cow in a vacuum.
Exactly.
And it's the ultimate, dunking on how academics can oversimplify things just to make the math clean. But here's the thing. I always thought that was just a joke for physics students. I didn't realize that for decades, macroeconomics has been doing pretty much the exact same thing.
We are guilty as charged. In the trade, we call it the representative firm.
Representative firm. It sounds, I don't know, very official.
It really does, doesn't it? But it's basically the spherical cow. For a long, long time, the standard models assumed the entire economy acted like one giant average factory. You've got this aggregate production function, you pour in labor and capital, and GDP just pops out the other side. The core assumption is that every firm is identical.
Or at least that the differences don't really matter.
Right, which feels okay if you're looking at a big national spreadsheet, but if you actually look out the window, it's obviously wrong.
Well, yeah, a startup in a garage is not a spherical cow.
Yeah.
Google isn't. The Quarter Bakery isn't. And pretending they're all the same just feels like you'd be blind to what's actually going on.
And that's the problem. The average can't tell you why startup culture might be struggling, or why wages are stagnant, or what we should do about big tech.
Because if everyone is average, monopolies can exist.
Exactly. So for this deep dive, we are ditching the representative firm.
We are getting into the source material on what are called heterogeneous firms.
Right. We're going to look at the economy not as one big machine, but as an ecosystem, like a forest, you know? You have these
Right.
ancient redwoods blocking out the sun, you have saplings trying to push through,
And a lot of stuff dying on the forest floor.
a whole lot of decay. And what's wild is that the research suggests this whole circle of life, how firms are born, grow, and die, that's the main driver of whether a country gets rich or stays poor.
It's the engine.
It is. And if you interfere with that life cycle, even with policies that sound, incredibly compassionate, you can accidentally grind that whole engine to a halt.
Okay, so before we get into how we break the engine, let's just look at the thing itself. What does the American business landscape actually look like? Are we a nation of small businesses, or are we all just corporate drones?
It's a bit of a paradox, actually. If you just look at the raw number of companies, the American dream seems alive and well. The business dynamics statistics say there are over 5 million firms in the US,
5 million.
and the vast, vast majority are tiny. I mean, we're talking 1 to 4 employees, your local plumber, the freelance designer, that coffee shop on the corner, that's the long tail.
Okay, so statistically, most businesses are really small.
But then you ask, where do people actually work? And the picture just flips completely upside down.
How so?
Half, 50% of all US employees work for firms with more than 1,000 staff.
Wow.
And nearly 30%, so almost 1 in 3 workers, is employed by a firm with over 10,000 people.
30%. That actually explains so much about the cultural consolidation we feel. It feels like everyone has the same corporate HR training because, well, a third of us basically do.
And that concentration is getting worse. It's increasing. Since the 90s, we've seen this big shift toward these mega firms. And maybe not coincidentally, we've also seen a rise in markups.
Which is just the price over the cost of production, really.
Basically, yeah, the big firms are getting bigger and more dominant.
But is that inherently a bad thing? I mean, big firms have scale, they can be efficient. I get cheap socks from Walmart because they're massive.
Scale itself isn't bad, but stagnation is. And the data shows this really worrying trend that economists are calling declining dynamism.
Dynamism is one of those words. It sounds important, but what does it actually look like in the data?
It looks like churn. We measure two things, the job creation rate and the job destruction rate.
Okay.
Creation is new firms starting up or existing ones expanding. Destruction is firms shrinking or going bust. In a healthy, dynamic economy, both of those numbers should be high.
Wait, hold on. We want job destruction to be high. That sounds like we want people to get fired.
Well, not people, but positions. We want the positions at bad, unproductive firms to disappear so that those workers and that capital can move to better, more productive firms.
Right, sure.
Back in the day, both the creation and destruction rates were over 10% a year. The economy was constantly shuffling the deck, but lately, both are trending down.
So the whole economy is kind of ossifying. People are staying in their jobs longer, but maybe it's not because they love them, it's just because there aren't as many new options popping up.
That's the worry. And bad firms aren't dying as fast. This brings us to this really crucial study by Foster, Haltiwanger, and Krizan from 2001. They asked a simple question. Where does productivity actually come from?
And I would guess it comes from everyone just getting a little better at their job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I learn a new Excel shortcut, the factory down the road buys a faster machine, and boom, we all produce 2% more next year.
That's the really intuitive view, isn't it? But what they found in U.S. manufacturing, at least, was that only about 45% of productivity growth came from that, from existing firms just improving their own operations.
Okay, so less than half comes from self-improvement.
Yeah.
Where is the other 55% coming from?
Reallocation. A full 55% of the growth came from high productivity firms getting bigger and low productivity firms shrinking or just exiting altogether.
That's kind of brutal.
It is.
So we talk about the economy like it's a school where we want every student to improve their grades. But you're saying it's more like a professional sports league.
How do you mean?
Well, the league doesn't just get better because every player trains a little harder. It gets better because the bad players get cut from the team and the star players get more playing time.
That is a perfect analogy. It is survival of the fittest. And this is the key takeaway. If you stop that churn, if you try to save the bad players from getting cut, you don't just, like, pause your growth. You actively kill more than half of your potential progress.
And this brings us to this idea of misallocation.
Yes. This is where the work of Xi and Klenau is so famous. They argue that a lot of poor countries aren't just poor because they lack technology. They're poor because their resources, their people, their capital are stuck in the wrong firms.
Tech hell, exactly.
Okay, imagine two firms. One is a brilliant high-tech manufacturer that could take over the world. The other is a dusty, inefficient plant still using tech from the 1950s.
Right.
In a perfect market, the high-tech firm would grow and hire everyone away from that dusty old plant. The old plant goes bust. That's reallocation at work.
Okay, makes sense.
But now imagine there's a government policy, maybe a subsidy for the old plant because it's historic, or maybe a special tax on the tech firm because it's growing too fast.
So now the labor stays stuck in the dusty plant.
Exactly. That is misallocation. The entire economy's productivity drops. Not because anyone forgot how to work, but because they're all working in the wrong place.
I get the theory, but let's get specific because this is where it gets real. The source material goes deep on firing taxes.
Yeah, this is based on the Hopenhain and Rodgerson model, and it is a classic case of good intentions paving the road to, well, to stagnation.
So let me play devil's advocate. I'm a policymaker. I see a recession looming. I want to protect workers. So I pass a law. If you fire someone, you have to pay a big penalty, like 6 months of severance. That feels like a win for the worker. They get to keep their job.
It absolutely feels like a win for that current worker. And if you just look at the immediate data, you'll see what you expect. The job destruction rate plummets.
Yeah.
Firms stop firing people because it's just too expensive.
Oh, one for the little guy.
But you have to look at the other side. Firms aren't just thinking about today. They're planning for tomorrow. If I'm a business owner and I know that hiring someone is basically like a marriage contract.
One you can't get out of without a massive penalty.
Exactly. What am I going to do?
We're going to be really, really careful about hiring anyone new.
I'm going to be paralyzed. I won't hire unless I am 100% certain I need that person for the next decade. And so in the model, the job creation rate just collapses.
Hold on, though. I mean, that sounds incredibly harsh. Are you saying a policy designed to keep people employed is bad because it keeps them employed?
Yeah.
Doesn't stability count for something? You know, the gig economy's flexibility isn't exactly a paradox.
And that's a very fair pushback. There's definitely a value to stability that these simple models can miss. Peace of mind, community, all of that. But the model is highlighting a cost that's usually invisible.
The unseen cost.
Right. You see the worker who kept their job. You don't see the new graduate who never got hired in the first place because that startup was too scared to expand.
It freezes the whole ecosystem.
Yeah.
The insiders stay inside. The outsiders get locked out.
That's it. And because the high productivity firms, the ones that should be growing, stop hiring, they can't displace the low productivity ones. The average productivity of the whole nation drops. In the model, you end up with lower total employment and lower wages in the long run.
You tried to save a specific job, but you ended up shrinking the entire job market.
That's the trade-off. And we see the same kind of dynamic with entry barriers.
Which is the cost to start a new business, right? The Kappa parameter.
Correct. Think of, you know, expensive licenses, endless permits, red tape. Who benefits when it costs $100,000 and 2 years of paperwork to open a new dental practice?
The dentists who are already in town. Less competition, They can charge more?
Of course. The incumbents love high entry barriers. Their business value goes up. But here's the really counterintuitive part from the model. When you raise those entry barriers, wages for workers go down.
Walk me through that. If the dentists are making more profit, shouldn't they pay their staff more?
You'd think so, but the market forces push the other way. If fewer new firms are entering the market, there's less competition for workers. The demand for labor drops. If I'm the only dental practice in town because no one else can afford the permit, I don't have to offer top dollar to keep my hygienists. Where else are they going to go?
So high barriers are basically a wealth transfer from labor to capital.
And to bring it back to our theme, it protects inefficient firms. A really crappy, badly run firm can survive for years if the barrier to entry is high enough to keep out any challengers.
Just amazing how interconnected it all is. You tweak one little licensing law, and 10 years later, wages are stagnant.
That's the whole point of general equilibrium thinking. You can't just look at the first domino.
Speaking of the bigger picture, I want to talk about the big one. We started this by saying the economy is dominated by these mega firms, the granular economy.
Right. The too big to fail question, but for, you know, production, not just banking.
Exactly. So the old view, the spherical cow view, relied on the law of large numbers.
Yes, which basically says that if you have millions of independent firms, their individual ups and downs should just cancel each other out. GM has a bad year, maybe Apple has a great year, and it all evens out.
So the volatility of the whole economy should be tiny.
It should be negligible. Mathematically, it should scale by 1 over the square root of n, and if n is 5 million firms, that number is effectively 0.
So that would imply that recessions must be caused by something that hits everyone at once, like a pandemic or an oil shock.
Exactly. It can't be firm specific.
But that's not what we see, is it?
No, because the firm sizes are not a bell curve. They're what's called a Pareto distribution. They have fat tails.
Which just means?
It means the biggest firms are wildly, incomprehensibly bigger than the average. And because of that, the cancellation effect breaks down. Xavier Gabé came up with what he calls the granular hypothesis. He showed that in a world with these fat tails, volatility doesn't scale by 1 over root n. It scales by 1 over log n.
I haven't done calculus in a while, but I know 1 over log n is a much, much bigger number.
Much, much bigger. Gabé calculated that the idiosyncratic shocks to just the top 100 firms in the U.S. can explain about a third of all the fluctuations we see in GDP.
That is terrifying. It means a third of our economic stability rests on the decisions made in, like, a dozen boardrooms.
And it gets even more intricate when you layer on Holton's theorem and these things called Domar weights.
Okay, this was the part of the reading that made my head spin. What is a Domar weight, and why isn't it just how big the company is?
So normally we measure a company's contribution to GDP by its value added, think profits plus wages, it's their net slice of the pie. But Holton showed that when you're thinking about how shocks move through the economy, value added is the wrong metric. You have to look at sales.
Sales divided by GDP. Mm-hmm. But why sales? A company could have huge sales, but tiny profits.
Think of a steel mill or maybe a specialized semiconductor manufacturer. Their profit margins might be razor thin, so their value added looks small. But their sales volume, that represents the sheer amount of stuff they are pushing into the supply chain.
Okay.
If that steel mill shuts down, it's not just their small profit that vanishes. The car factory that buys their steel stops. The construction company stops. The appliance maker stops. The ripple effect, the impact, is proportional to the total volume of goods they touch, their gross sales.
Ah, I see. So the Domar weight is a measure of the ripple effect.
It's a measure of the firm's reach, its interconnectedness. And today, we have firms with absolutely massive Domar weights. Think about Amazon. Their profit margin has historically been pretty thin, but their sales to GDP ratio, it's enormous. If they have a major logistics failure, that ripple hits almost every single household and business in the country.
So we're living in a glass house held up by just a few very, very large pillars.
We are living in a granular world. It's not a smooth gas that you can compress evenly. It's a pile of rocks. And if one of the big rocks shifts, the whole pile can slide.
We've talked about the structure, the rocks, the forest, the cow. But before we wrap, I want to touch on the spark, the innovation. Where do these productivity differences even come from in the first place?
Right. Why does one firm get big and another stay small? This is the world of the Clit and Cordham models. They see the economy as an innovation race.
A race implies a winner and a loser.
And that's the whole point. In their model, you don't just do R&D to make a better product in a vacuum. You do it to improve your quality so you can steal a customer from one of your competitors.
Creative destruction all over again.
Yes. It's a very aggressive view of innovation. A firm grows by taking market share from someone else. The math of it produces something called Jabrot's Law, which basically suggests that big and small firms grow at about the same rate on average.
Okay.
But the variance, the risk, is much higher for the small firms. The startup is swinging for the fences while the giant is just trying to protect its lead. But the key insight is that this race is what feeds the whole reallocation engine we've been talking about.
If firms stop trying to steal each other's customers, the sorting mechanism breaks.
It grinds to a halt. You need that race to identify the winners so that labor and capital can flow to them.
So let's try to pull all this together. We started with a spherical cow and ended up with a pile of shifting rocks. If I'm a listener trying to make sense of the news, what should I be looking for?
First, I'd say look at the help wanted signs differently. We often hear about labor shortages as a crisis. But remember, the movement of labor reallocation is the source of more than half of our productivity growth. A stagnant labor market is a dying market.
Churn is good, even when it feels a little chaotic.
Second, be skeptical of any policy that promises to protect specific jobs or industries without asking at what cost. Whether it's firing taxes or entry barriers, preventing the death of bad firms usually just means preventing the birth of good ones.
And the final takeaway.
Acknowledge the fragility. We aren't dealing with averages anymore. We are very dependent on a small number of these mega firms with huge domar weights.
Which brings me to this thought I've been mulling over.
What's that?
We usually talk about antitrust laws, you know, breaking up Google or Amazon in terms of consumer prices. The legal test is always, are they charging us too much?
Right, the consumer welfare standard.
But if these firms are now so granular, so systemically important, that one bad quarter from one CEO can ripple through the supply chain and actually affect national GDP, do we need to rethink antitrust? Maybe the reason to break them up isn't because they're expensive, but because they're just unstable.
That is a fascinating argument. You're basically asking for an antitrust for stability. If a firm's domar weight gets too high, does it become too big to fail in a way that actually threatens national security?
Exactly. We did it for the banks. Maybe it's time to start looking at the real economy the same way.
Well, that would certainly require a new breed of economists and probably a lot fewer spherical cows to figure out.
Until then, I guess we'll just have to keep watching the rocks shift. Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.